This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Insofar as the new constitution seeks to give even more powers to the head of state or the head of government, for critics of the draft constitution, it represents nothing but a continuation of military rule by other means. It's a repudiation of the ethos of decentralization.
That's Dr. Ebenezer Obadare, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, on next Sunday's referendum in Mali regarding the proposed draft constitution that gives the country's president unlimited power. Details coming up also. The World Food Program is scaling up food aid to support 5.9 million Sudanese as hunger rises. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Presidents Macky Sall of Senegal and Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa are heading a delegation that is visiting Kiev today and St. Petersburg tomorrow to press for an end to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The group also includes Egypt's prime minister and leader from Zambia and the Comoros. They're expected to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin, according to media reports. The African peace effort is just one of several initiatives aimed at ending the fighting in Ukraine. But what chances do the African leaders have resolving this conflict in Europe? VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached out to David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York, and began by asking about the trip.
The trip was delayed, so it had its own challenges, but they're on their way to Ukraine. I must say, Russia has launched missile strikes on Kiev, just as these leaders are getting into Ukraine. So I think that's a warning message from Russia to Ukraine. And it's going to be very difficult for these leaders to actually get a resolution. Firstly, because they are not from the region. They're from another continent. Secondly, because the diplomatic efforts from these African leaders are not backed by the coercive force of military. For any diplomacy to work, you need to have a military hand. So, for example, if you look at the problems we had in the former Yugoslavia, you had the no-fly zone. They had the diplomacy, but the NATO and the military backed up that diplomacy. This is absent in this case. So I think it's a good effort. Any diplomacy is always good. But the problem is there's so many bigger wars in Africa, in Sudan, in the DRC, in South Sudan, you know, that we really have not sorted out. So it's somewhat ironic for African leaders to be going to take care of problems in Ukraine when we have much bigger wars in Africa than even what's going on in Ukraine.
Most African leaders have claimed they are impartial in this conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And some of them have a lot of relationship with Russia from days, colonial days. What do you think prompted them now to embark on this effort?
So that's a good, great question. I think South African foreign policy, particularly the generation of the Thabo Mbekis and Cyril Ramaphosa, these are individuals who have very close relationships with Russia, which used to be the former Soviet Union, and the support that Russia gave the ANC during the dark days of apartheid. So I think a lot of that generation is now in leadership in South Africa, and you really see that coming through. To your earlier question about the challenges of the diplomacy that Ramaphosa is leading, I think Ukraine has tended to see South Africa as being biased in favor of Russia against Ukraine. And I say that because South Africa has maintained close relationships with Russia through the BRICS conference, BRICS organization. But let's also not forget that at the anniversary of this Ukraine war, South Africa welcomed the president of China and a Russian ship into South African ports. So that, even diplomatically, it's not a good symbol because it appears that South Africa is biased towards Russia and is not sensitive to the plight of Ukraine. That being said, The historical connections between Ramaphosa and Russia are very strong. Ramaphosa has tended to align South African foreign policy, at least rhetorically, a lot closer with China and Russia. But I think, as I said before, the diplomatic efforts will be very challenging, particularly given the fact that as much as South Africa is a major power on the continent, in a global scale, South Africa is still very limited in what it can do outside of the Southern African region.
What do you think the leadership in Russia and Ukraine make of these efforts by the African leaders?
To be honest with you, it's for me, it's very comical. I think the Russians and Ukrainians accept the diplomatic initiative in good faith, because you don't want to embarrass heads of state from Africa, from any country for that matter, that come and want to do good. But the irony is, Africa has so many of these internal civil wars which have been forgotten and are still being forgotten. Courtesy begins at home. What's happening in Sudan right now, the genocide that's going on there, in the DRC, in Chad, the military takeovers in many countries in West Africa, Guinea, Mali, Burkina Faso, the migration problem we have in Libya, and the abuses of migrants from many countries. And even in South Africa itself, the xenophobic hate and violence towards migrants from other African countries in major cities in South Africa like Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town. So the continent really has so many of its own problems. This mission really seems very tokenist. It's very minimalist. It's very ironic in its whole framing, and I think it's been poorly thought out.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from New York. Meanwhile, Polish authorities say a plane carrying members of Ramaphosa's security team was detained yesterday at Warsaw Chopin Airport. The situation resulted from a failure to comply with standard entry procedures required by the Polish government. Dangerous goods were on board the plane, which South African representatives did not have permission to bring in. In addition, there were persons on board the aircraft of whose presence the Polish side had not been notified about beforehand. Steps are being taken to resolve the situation. Mali's military is holding a referendum on a new constitution Sunday, a key step towards a return to constitutional rule and a presidential election expected next year in the Western African country. The draft constitution would considerably strengthen the power of the president to determine national policy, appoint the prime minister and other ministers, and terminate their functions. Dr. Ebenezer Obadare is a Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He tells me there are many critical elements within Malian society against the proposed process that gives the president unlimited power.
Insofar as the new constitution seeks to give even more powers to the head of state or the head of government, for critics of the draft constitution, it represents nothing but a continuation of military rule by other means. It's a repudiation of the ethos of decentralization. And that's why many civil society organizations, many critical elements within the Malian society have refused to take part in the process and are asking, their supporters and their followers to distance themselves from the process. The other thing, the other problem that elements within Malian civil society are pointing out as a problem with this process is that it's been put in place by the head of state, Assimi Goïta. Many civil society elements, many members of the political elite also believe that it's one thing to want to revise the constitution. It's another thing to have that process supervised by a military government. So for that reason, they are opposed to the process itself.
And then there is this other thing too that has already triggered controversy, and that is a part of the draft states that Mali is an independent, sovereign, unitary, indivisible, democratic, secular, and social republic. But the imams, a powerful class in the country, have been contesting the principle of secularism and have called on Muslims to oppose it.
Absolutely. So you have what is called LIMAMA, which is the League of Imams and Scholars for Islamic Solidarity. And their grounds against the draft constitution is that it suggests that Mali be a secular state. They want that language changed to either a multi-faith state or a multi-confessional state. Mali is 95% Muslim. It's a majority Muslim state. The Muslim elite, the ulamas and all of that, they have a lot of authority and a lot of influence within the system. So whether or not you like what they're saying, their position for against secularism, it's a very important constituency that you want to listen to.
And then Mali also, as you know, Doctor, is in the throes of an 11-year-old security crisis triggered by regional revolt in the north that developed into a full-blown rebellion. So frustration that the French troops who had been in the country since 2013 could not root out the rebels. Now the French are gone. The Russians, the Wagner group is circling the Malian generals.
So it's a very important question because it brings to the table the question of security. This is one of the reasons why there was a military coup d'etat in August 2020 that brought Assimi Goïta to power. The promise was that we're going to make sure that this country is secure. We're going to ensure security across the country. The French were the problem. The French then withdrew and then they brought in the Russian backed Wagner group. What has transpired is that that has not necessarily brought security in its wake. So the government now has its work cut out for it, right? Whoever takes control next year, hopefully after the presidential election, will have to contend with the fact that the Malian state is not, it's not whole, that there's a lot of problems, and that, you know, something has to be done with respect to the security situation.
And lastly, Doctor, is Assimi Goïta going to be the president?
So that's a very interesting question. That is the suspicion. So remember I mentioned earlier that so many critical elements within the Malian society are against this very process, especially the fact that you have a revised constitution that strengthens the hand of the state against the judiciary, that gives the head of government the power to disband the National Assembly. The suspicion is that Assimi Goïta himself is calculating, you know, as an intent on, you know, transitioning to a civilian head of state and then continue to maintain his handle, you know, on power. So that's the suspicion. Now, that has yet to happen. But if experience from other parts of West Africa or Africa, where a military head of state has transitioned to civilian head of state, if that experience is anything to go by, then one might rightly expect Mr. Goïta to do the same next year.
That was Dr. Ebenezer Obadare, Douglas Dillon Senior Fellow of Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. In related news, former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who is now the Special Envoy of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, and is leading the mediation mission in Mali, says, after consulting with the junta leaders on the referendum, he has briefed Nigeria's President Bola Ahmed Tinubu, as well as other regional leaders in the area. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The World Food Program is scaling up food aid to support 5.9 million people across Sudan over the next 6 months as hunger rises in the war-torn country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WFP reports it has provided emergency food assistance and nutrition support to nearly 1 million people in 14 of 18 Sudan states since the aid agency resumed its life-saving operations on May 3rd. Speaking from Port Sudan, WFP's acting country director for Sudan, Abdurrahman Maygag, warns an estimated 2 to 2.5 million Sudanese are expected to slip into hunger in the coming months due to the ongoing violence. He says the security situation makes it very challenging to provide aid to this desperately needy population. He says WFP assistance, assets, and premises have been repeatedly attacked and looted, hampering efforts to reach vulnerable families in dire need of assistance.
Over 40,000 tons of food have been stolen and looted. That is around one-third of the total stocks WFP had in the country before the conflict. The total value of losses so far stands at over $89 million.
The Federal Ministry of Health reports more than 1,000 people have been killed and over 11,700 injured since fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid defense forces erupted April 15th. The World Health Organization reports approximately one-third of Sudan's population of more than 45.6 million people already was facing hunger before the fighting began. WHO spokeswoman Carla Drysdale warns the risk of worsening malnutrition is imminent because growing numbers of people are unable to access or afford to buy food in local markets.
4 million children and pregnant and breastfeeding women are acutely malnourished. More than 100,000 under five children with severe acute malnutrition with medical complications are in need of specialized care at stabilization centers.
She adds an estimated 50,000 severely acutely malnourished children need ongoing round-the-clock care. The WFP says it is very concerned that the ongoing conflict could undermine the current planting season. It notes insecurity and soaring prices of fertilizer and seeds could lead to a below-average harvest in September. Were that to happen, it says acute food insecurity in Sudan could rise to record levels. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New Nigerian President Bola Tinubu has approved the indefinite suspension of the country's anti-graft chief, Abdul Rashid Bawa. Willie Bassey, Director of Information of the Office of the Secretary to the Government, announced the suspension. He said in a statement, there are weighty allegations of abuse of office leveled against Bawa, the chairman of the Economic and Financial Commission. The statement also said the suspension will allow for proper investigation of the allegations. Chiku Nanabufi, a media administrator and journalist, told reporter Mike Mbonye that people should wait for the outcome of the investigation.
My first reaction when the news got to us in our newsroom was shock. And I felt a little bit disheartened because Bawa represents a generation of youth with vibrance and strong promise in the firmament called Nigerian politics. And he also came across to me, hitherto, as very bright. But when we got to the president's action, and why it was done, it was exactly something that should be done that way.
Some analysts think that the action taken by President Bola Tinubu is aimed at sanitizing or checking or fighting corruption in the country. Do you think this will help to put fears or sanitize the system in Nigeria in the fight against corruption?
Fear is not needed in democracy, in administering a state, although fear is a tool in getting people to keep in line. but fear is not what is needed. So if you use fear in the general, banal, and common sense of the word, it is negative, it is not needed. But it is an action that is well needed to show that there are consequences for dereliction of duty, consequences for corruption. Because one of the problems that Nigeria has is that people see a lot of action. Although we can't judge now because he's on suspension to... suspension implies almost extremity, that he's on suspension to clear his name, and I pray he come out innocent. And I presume him innocent until proved guilty. But in the way of penalty for action, it is needed for corruption to be seen, to be checked, and for the president to be seen, to be acting in that direction of checking corruption.
Successive regimes, successive administrations in Nigeria have said that the fight against corruption is total and will be won. What's your take? What's your assessment of the fight against corruption in Nigeria so far?
My assessment is from the point of why the fight against corruption seems not to be gaining traction or not to be succeeding as we would wish it to do. The problem is that corruption is a symptom. It's not the ailment to address. The issue, I believe, is getting Nigerians to believe in Nigeria, getting Nigerians to love Nigeria, getting Nigerians to believe in themselves and in their neighbors.
And do you think this will help to check or fight corruption in Nigeria?
When you get Nigerians to love Nigeria, as most countries have done, they will do lesser harm to Nigeria. Or you get them to love their fellow Nigerians, that is cross-ethnic, cross-religious, cross-tribal, they will also do lesser harm to their fellow Nigerians.
That was Chuka Nanembufi, a media administrator. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Oweri, southeast Nigeria. Nine people have been arrested in Greece in connection with the sinking of a boat of that country's southern coast Wednesday that killed at least 78 people. The suspects are being held on allegations of people smuggling and participating in a criminal enterprise. While 104 people were rescued, the trawler, which capsized and sank, was believed to have carried as many as 750 people, according to the International Organization for Migration. The Associated Press reports that 27 of those rescued remain hospitalized. Some of the survivors have been so traumatized that they still believe they are on the boat and are going to die, according to a Reuters report. And Pope Francis has left a hospital in Rome where he underwent an operation for a hernia more than a week ago. Francis left the Gemelli Hospital in a wheelchair. Asked by well-wishers how he felt, the 86-year-old Pope said, "Still alive." When he arrived at the Vatican today, he got out of his car to individually thank members of his Italian police escort. The pontiff has suffered a number of maladies since his election, including hip problems, knee pain, weight gain, an inflamed colon, and respiratory infection. While Francis has said he would consider stepping down if his health were to fail him, he has said recently that he has no current plans to quit. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.